My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's wilde.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi everyone and welcome back. This is Patricia Kathleen and I am gobsmacked today to be sitting down with Karen Clark Cole. She is the CEO and co-founder of Blink. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Thank you. There is not a brief bio on Karen, and if I was going to glaze over it quickly, it wouldn't do it justice. So I'm going to get into, I think, the briefest bio I could absolutely handle describing Karen before we launch into our podcast today. So Karen is the CEO and co-founder of Blink UX. Karen is primarily focused on Blink's culture, employees, communicating the company vision, and setting the company's growth strategy. She is also the chief operations officer at Blink. Karen began her career studying fine arts in Vancouver, BC at the Emily Carr College of Art and Design. She holds a degree in art history and visual arts from the University of Victoria, and is a graduate of the Information Technology and Multimedia program from Capilano University, Vancouver. Karen also started a PhD program in values-driven leadership at the Benedictine University in 2015. Through her work at Blink, Karen was a winner of the 2016 Enterprising Women of the Year Award, and she was a finalist for Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award in 2015. In 2016, Blink was listed in Forbes magazine's Best 25 Small Companies in America list and has won the Puget Sound Business Journal's Washington's Fastest Growing Private Companies Award in 2015 and 2012, Seattle's Business Magazine Tech Impact Silver Award in 2015, the Women's President's Organization's 50 Fastest Growing Women-Led Companies Worldwide Award in 2014, and was listed on Inc. magazine's top 5,000 fastest growing companies in America's list in 2015, 2014, 2013, and 2012. Karen is an active member and speaker for the International Leadership Association, an active member in the Small Giants community, and a board member for the World Trade Center. Karen is currently the executive director and president of the board for the nonprofit organization she founded in early 2014, Girls Can Do. Girls Can Do is an event series for girls with the mission to inspire a generation of possibility thinkers and ignite a vision for equal opportunity. Karen currently writes a column for Forbes.com on the Entrepreneurs Channel and has been written about in Inc. Magazine, Puget Sound Business Journal, GeekWire Magazine, Seattle Business Magazine, Center for Values-Driven Leadership, St. Margaret's School, Chapter B, LTD Daily, and the Pacific Institute. Karen was born and raised in Victoria, Canada, and loves to ski, run, garden, kiteboard, and hang out with her amazing daughter. That is such an amazing bio. I love it. And we were talking earlier, what is your most favorite or a key piece that I think I missed with the Small Giants community? What was left off there?
The Forbes Award was connected with the Small Giants community.
Okay.
So when we got the top 25 companies in the country, that was connected with Small Giants.
Okay, that's yeah. a lit. That's an
They're
armor.
A great organization.
That's a yeah. litany. I think I might just hold that up anytime I talk to anyone. Read this, and I will chat. So for all of you listening, really quickly, I'm going to follow the roadmap that I do with a lot of these series, and we're going to first touch on. We're going to let Karen kind of expand on her academic history and professional life following that. Then we're going to jump straight into Blink and. Some of the really interesting aspects happening with the company culture and exciting things on the horizon, goals for the next 3 to 5 years, expansion always. And then we're going to get into the Girls Can Do nonprofit, and then we will wrap up the conversation with advice Karen has for those of you out there and listening. So will you drop us straight into your academic background?
Sure. From high school, I graduated and then went straight into art school. And at art school, I was focused on photography, mostly printmaking. So I did studied lithography.
Nice.
And other forms of printmaking. The most important thing, though, about that particular bit of education that I had is the critical thinking classes that we took. So in art school, a big part of what you do in art school is you put your work on the wall. You learn to give feedback, you learn to get feedback in this critique forum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a part of that is the many classes that we all had to take in support of that around critical thinking. And so essentially what they were doing is training us how to think outside the box, which I always say every CEO should go to art school for that very reason.
Absolutely.
It really set me up for life. And so then after that, at the time, the Emily Carr didn't have a degree program, and I wanted to get a degree, so they do now. But I switched over and finished up in Victoria, where I was raised at UVic there with an art history degree with a minor in visual arts. Mm-hmm. So love of art, I thought I was going to be an artist, and then I decided at some point in that time that I didn't really want to be a starving artist, and I wasn't that good, so I should probably do something else. But in between the... going to finishing at UVic, I did a lot of traveling around Europe in, you know, during school, and then when I was done, I spent a year traveling around Europe and worked in Spain for a year.
Nice.
And then I eventually came back and went to what I call multimedia school. It was called Information Technology in Vancouver, and at the time, this was really when CD-ROMs were quite popular, but the internet was not. So this was before the web, which is sort of hard to imagine. It was in the early, mid-90s.
Yeah.
And the focus there was on taking my art school training and turning into digital. So graphic design was really my emphasis there. And I thought if I can learn computer graphics, then that might, you know, have better future for a job. And the real inspiration there was, I'll never forget it, there was a moment, I had an uncle in Vancouver who was a well-established graphic designer, and he showed me on his computer this big old Mac computer that you stick a disc in. And he showed me this CD-ROM that Peter Gabriel had made for his album. And I could not believe it. It was the coolest thing I had ever seen.
Yeah. Because,
you know, there were rooms and you click something and sound would play and people would move. And it was, you know, it was an interactive CD-ROM. And that was the first time I'd ever seen anything like it. And it combined sort of everything I loved. It was, you know, the music and the movement and the visuals and the storytelling. And so then at that moment I knew that's what I'm going to do. So yeah. That's when I went back to the multimedia school in Vancouver. And at that school, they taught us everything. Like, we had to take apart computers, learn how to code, learn how to do, you know, lots of heavy-duty computer graphics and write stories. And at the end of that, we produced we each had our own story CD-ROM that we built everything on it.
How did that sit well with your artistic history? I like this because there's an argument that, you know, you have artists and then you have scientists and computer programmers, and I don't believe that. I think those personalities
programming is very creative. I love it. You know, and this is in the days when we were for this program, we were working in Director, which is long gone now, but it was a fun thing. And HTML. So it was before WYSIWYG, so I was actually coding HTML. Mm-hmm. And it's very creative because you do something and then you see it, you see your art move, and it was so fun for me. Director in particular is a program that's really meant for visualizing moving visualization, so it's motion graphics, a lot of that kind of stuff.
Nice. So you found no difficulty.
I loved it. It was super fun.
Excellent.
Yeah, super fun. So then from that program, that sort of launched my career into the digital world that I'm in now. But I should say before that, I was in my late 20s at the time, I guess. So I had been messing around quite a bit before I went back to this multimedia school. And I had, every job known to man. So my favorite jobs that I tell people about are I was a flagger at a construction site, I was a security guard, I lifeguarded a lot.
Nice.
I worked in a lot of restaurants. So I sort of did all these jobs, which I think have built appreciation for just sort of understanding people around me, particularly in a restaurant. You know, you got to work really hard. And so, and then I also just appreciated hard work. And anyway, so I went back to a multimedia school, and then I got a job right after that working for a company that developed cultural CD-ROMs. And at the time, they were educational. And so this was, again, instead of the internet, because it really was just getting going then.
Yep.
And still the mainstream. So we worked on a big project for the National Archives of Canada. And this is to help, it would go into schools and, you know, people would buy this to learn about all the history of Canada. So, you know, obviously that's sort of, it's really kind of irrelevant now, but it was super fun and very intensely creative environment, this company that I worked for. And then from there I went and worked on for another company where we were more web focused, because I thought this is sort of where it's all going. Mm-hmm. So I worked for them for a while, and this is at the time where the graphic designer would typically be doing the interaction side of it on websites, because it wasn't a separate career at that point to be designing the information movement and sort of the interactivity of a website. So I found that was the part that I liked most, because I liked the logical side of it. I liked the organizing of the information and the content and the interactivity. So when you clicked on something, where would you go and what would that thing be called and how do you make it intuitive? And I really naturally enjoyed that. And so I'm an organizer. So I always, in the early days of Blink, when we were interviewing people, I would always ask them this weird question, which is, you know, what does your sock drawer look like?
Yeah.
And if they were like, well, it's organized by, you know, small socks, you know, blue socks, ankle socks, high socks, and it's all nicely ordered, and you could open the drawer and know exactly which was what, then they would get the job. And so this is how I am. Like, you go through my house, you go through the linen drawer, and like all the little ones are combined in separate from the big ones, and you know, the spices are all nicely organized. So I sort of naturally love organizing
user interface stuff. The entire house.
Exactly. So I was sort of born for this thing. So then I wanted to do more of that. And in Vancouver, you couldn't get a job just focused on the information architecture, really in all of Canada. However, the industry was really picking up more quickly in the States. So I managed to get a job in Seattle. And so I moved down and started working for a pretty big web development company in Seattle, mm-hmm. where I could do this job full time.
Right.
So that's sort of how the early stages of education mapped into those early jobs. And then I had a couple jobs in between there, actually. I went back to Victoria for a while and worked on some educational CD-ROMs. So really digital right from the beginning.
And what about the birth for Blink? Tell us that story.
Yeah, so I came down and worked for this full service development company. And what was happening is this thing that we had that was still new, called information architecture at the time,
mm-hmm.
This company was one of the few in the country that really had it as a separate discipline within the organization. And clients were coming to us, and we were largely working for big software companies at the time. And they were building, you know, this was in the, you know, the really the dot-com burst was picking up. It was in full swing. And, you know, there was no sight and end at this point. This was in the late 90s.
Yeah.
It's in, late 99, I believe. And so, you know, this is when software was still being built by engineers. So it wasn't designed, and there was no thinking about who was going to use this thing, how could it be easy for them. It was just built by what made sense to the engineers.
Yes.
And this was totally common, and then it would be shipped with a giant manual. I mean, you look at the old days of Microsoft. Your Word would be shipped with a huge manual, and good luck trying to figure it out.
Yes.
And that was the expectation.
I feel like searching the internet, Netscape. You know, in the beginning, every little word perfect, no misspellings.
Sure.
No human error. You know, the human's not doing that work.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, so it was really very much like that. And so what was happening, though, is that there were a few companies, you know, Apple is one of them for sure, where they started doing it a little bit differently. They were designing their software. And so then people sort of got a glimpse of, wow, it doesn't have to be terrible and awful. And it's like, imagine building a big building with no architect. The builders just got to come in one day and start hammering nails and putting up boards wherever they felt like, whatever made sense to them. And you hope that all of the construction people were in alignment at least so they could be working together, but they may not be.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody would have to move in and you're like, well, why is the door on the side of the building and the stairs on the other side? It would be like that.
Right.
And so, but it, and it was the complexity and the importance of these big software systems. It was really the same, but with no architects. And so we came in and this new field became started developing of designing the software from every single instance. And so we would start with research, understanding who was using it, understand their motivations, you know, what's their context of use, why are they coming to this, how can we help them, how can it make their lives better, easier, more meaningful, and then really going to work and taking that as input into our designs. And then our designs would end up being complete blueprints of the system. So we would design what we call wireframes, which are grayscale skeleton sketches of the system. So a page would look like line drawings, essentially, of this is what the page needs to look like. These are exactly what the links need to be called, and this is exactly where they will go. And each page of where it would go would be mapped out. And we would start at the home page, and we would go all the way down to the very end of a transaction and make sure that it worked. And then we would do that for an entire system. So if you think about online banking, there's a lot of screens that come up before you get your money moved. And we would design all of that and the whole, what's the whole experience like. So what was happening, though, is that these big software companies, they wanted to hire this firm we worked for called Siteworks at the time to do just this piece that they didn't have and come in and work with their team. So they had strategists, they had developers, they had QA people, they had visual designers, but they didn't have this information architecture piece. But this company couldn't do that because they needed to, in order for them to stay in business and keep everyone busy, they needed big million-dollar contracts that had the whole shebang, and they couldn't farm out these little pieces. So I just saw that, and we were being pulled into all of the sales calls to talk about what we were doing and how it was different, and it sort of became the big thing that everybody wanted. So I thought, well, what if we just went and did that on our own and only did that? Then
yes,
we could perhaps help these companies. So I convinced my coworker, who became my co-founder, to leave, and we did this together. And so we always describe it as he had a lot more experience at doing this than I did at the time. And so I always describe it as he was the brains and I was the guts, which was the perfect combination, really.
Yeah, it is.
So
how long did it take you to convince yourself? Do you recall? I like moments.
6 months.
When we think, it took you that long to convince your co-founder or yourself?
No, it took 6 months before I saw the opportunity. And then immediately I thought, we should do this. You know, about
That's
10
it.
Seconds.
Just let's go.
Yeah, there was one moment where it was after a sales call. And I actually do remember the moment. I was sitting on the, there's a two-story building, and I was on the bottom story sitting at the desk of this sales guy, and you know, and I was saying, what if we should just go do that? And he's like, you should just go that. And it was like total validation at that moment. I'm like, that's it. That's what
Johnny said, so let's go.
Right. And so because he just validated that he was seeing this across the board, not just in the opportunities that I had seen. And so so right away I went to work trying to figure out how to do this. And
How did you know your co-founder? Did you scope out a series of people at that job, or did you know exactly who you were?
There were
going
only
to try to take?
3 and 4 of us at one point on the team, and he was the senior person in the group who had hired me, and we got along really well, so we were friends.
Okay.
So he was the only obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, for me at the time, I had no risk. You know, I was renting a house at the time. I had my cat, and I had my old 77 pickup. So,
which I want.
Yeah,
I've
it was
heard
awesome.
Description of it, a dent in the
my
side.
My green with a dent in the side. My grandpa gave it to me, and it had got a lot of miles. You know, I didn't. There was sort of, why not for me and for Kelly, my co-founder. He had to think about it a little bit longer. He had a wife, and they were about to start a family, and so, you know, all of a sudden going from a nice salary to nothing was not as easy for him to do, and so. But, you know, we finally decided, you know, let's give it a try. And we're very employable, so if it doesn't work out, we'll go get a job somewhere else.
Right.
And so we did that, and I managed to get space for us just down the street. So, you know, like literally a block away, there was an ad agency that had some free space, and they wanted to learn more about the digital world. So they subleased the space to us. I think we paid nothing, actually, at first. It was important to us that we had a real presence, that we weren't doing this in our garage, that we, you know, we wanted to look legitimate from the beginning,
right?
Because we had been working in this business and saw as consultants, you know, we had to look, if we were going to be selling these expensive services, which they were quite expensive, then we had to look like we had our act together. So we, and clients generally, for some reason, I don't really know why, they always wanted to come, at least when we were working at this other company together, the clients always wanted to come to us. And so we wanted to make sure that that was still possible. So right. we had a great place right in Post Alley, which is very iconic in Seattle. Mm-hmm. The, you know, right away we had a receptionist, we had a conference room and a photocopier and a fridge and, you know, desks and all the things that you needed to be legitimate.
Legitimate, so yeah, I was just going to
say. It was really great. And somebody even answering the phone. So that worked out really well. So that was 8 months after
you,
I had got there.
That immediate kind of like, you know, these all these visual markers and slightly physical as well. But do you think that that helped legitimize it in your head, or were you legitimate from the moment you just started?
No, I think you're right. I think it really does help. Mm-hmm. So for me, I don't work at home. Well, occasionally I do, but it's very important to me to get dressed and go to work. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, the clothes I wear to work are not the clothes that I ever wear when I'm not at work, and vice versa.
Right.
And because part of it is I sort of put on work, and it also helps me decompress from work, because if the minute I get home at the end of the day, I take off my work clothes, I change,
yeah.
and I put on my sweats. And that, you know, I'm like, okay, great, that's the distinction for me. And so part of it is too, is I like to go into the office and I like to see, and then I'm like at work. And it's very, because I'm focused, it sort of helps me, you know, focus on the environment that's correct at the time, which is work.
Yeah.
So going to work is important for me. And I think it did. It helped us come in and people expect you to be there. And sure, and you sort of see how the world sees you, which I think is also really important. Mm-hmm. You know, because we could sort of exist in our own little basement and not get a sense of, is this meaningful or not? And so being in a physical space where we're interacting even with the other people in the ad agency, sort of hearing them express how interesting and unique it was, the work that we were doing, was certainly great and validating.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you think that that carried in? So you've got the two of you. How much of that like personal dialogue or culture, your personal culture, do you think started to help build that, which became this huge, you know, titan of Blink?
Well, I can tell you, you know, Kelly and I are aligned to this day, so almost 20 years later. You could ask each of us, and in fact, he's here. I'll introduce you to him. He's in the office here. We're in San Diego today. We will always give you the same answer, which is quality is number one. And so, the taking care of our clients, treating them like friends, understanding what their problem is, and then helping them. And so if they're coming to something from we have this new product or this new idea that we think is going to make a difference in the world, and we don't really know how to design it or interview our customers to get the right information out of them, can you help us? Like, yeah, that sounds fun. And so we basically just come together and help each other. They've got a cool idea. We know how to design it and help them in the way that's meaningful for their customers, not for us. And then when we come together, it's a magic moment. You know, like we really, there's no chucking it over the fence. There's no, you know, you hire us, we'll go away and invent this great thing and give it back to you. We always tell clients, when you hire us, you're going to spend twice as much time working with us than half the time. So don't expect to have efficiencies in your schedule by hiring us. It's going to take you more effort. Hmm. But the results will be outrageous. Yeah. And they really always are, because we approach it like that. It's a very, very close relationship, and we are on team together, and so they're just part of our team. Mm-hmm. And we call them like that. You're just, you know, this is the team, and they're representing their business, they're representing, you know, the genesis of the product idea or the business model, or, you know, those aspects of it, and we're representing, and the domain for sure, and we're representing the design side, you know. And it's our job to get up to speed pretty quickly on the domain, because we work across all industries. Mm-hmm. But with their help, and understand, and then we spend so much time deeply understanding their customers, that it's just such a great melding of minds by the end of that.
So that's the culture, the relationship between you and clients. Can you speak more to the culture at Blink within itself?
Sure. That though, I think it's really important, because that's the basis of it. So,
right.
You know, if that's how Kelly and I started, is like, hey, so the most important thing at Blink is to understand that we are, you know, authentic is our one value. So we boiled it down to one word, because when you have more than that, I think it's too hard to remember. And so, you know, there's one basic thing, which is we aren't pulling the wool over anyone's eyes. And so we are authentic in our relationships with each other in the company, mm-hmm. In that if you need help, you should ask for it immediately. So no one has to pretend that they know something they don't, or that they don't have as much experience, or they could use some help figuring out an idea. my God, we hired you because you're smart, so let's all help each other. So that is very prevalent in the company and how Kelly and I always were and still are. And so, and that feeds right to our clients. So it's being authentic with our clients and saying, hey, I'm not sure about that, or we can't help you with that, but let me hook you up with someone who can, or, mm-hmm. you know, like, let's figure this out together. And not being afraid to be like that is really an important part of our culture. And that takes people who have a certain amount of confidence and willingness to be vulnerable in some ways, who are employees. Right. You know, they're willing, it's okay, you don't have to make something up, just say you don't know. It's fine.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and then the other side of it is, it's a massive amount of care and attention and hard work. And so, you know, for example, right now, Kelly's here, and I he's gluing something, and I asked him what he's doing, and he said, because we have a big open house in our San Diego office tomorrow night, and I said, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm fixing the doorbell. It's awful. I said, oh my God, I sent you a text. I didn't know he was here. And I was saying, can you fix the doorbell? So, you know, even after 20 years, we're doing stuff like that. So
yeah.
not because it's anyone's job or not anyone's job, because it needs to get done.
And both, you know, founders thought of it.
Right.
Well, no one was about
because we care about this level of detail. And so yeah. That's why we have had such a great partnership over the years. And that's why, you know, these are the things that the company is seated on, and this is what we care about. So when we interview people, we talk about these kind of things. You know, if the coffee's not made, then just go make it. You know, it's not, you don't not do it because it's not in your job description. We all chip in here. And so we try to keep that culture of close family, even as we're getting bigger. And it's definitely harder, and you need more people sort of helping to move that ball to create, you know, keep that culture and hold it. Mm-hmm. But it's totally possible, and it's really, you just have to pay close attention.
Well, yeah, and I'm curious about that as well, because there's a dialogue, it seems like a little bit of delicate dancing every now and again. So you have several different offices across the country, and it seems like there's a bit of choreography that happens for it. You develop this kind of culture within one office, mm-hmm. and then you have a completely separate location, and you want to keep the culture similar, but still allow for
right.
this kind of, you know, unique geographically based, you
yeah.
know, culture to happen within it, but also have this fluid, you know, translation, if you will, between the two. Can you speak to that? And also, first, will you mention all the different places you have offices?
Sure. We're in Austin, Boston, San Diego, San Francisco, and Seattle. And so Seattle's headquarters, that's where we started, so that's our largest office. So headquarters sits there, and then we also have Seattle delivery team. And I separate them because we, you know, delivery is unique in each office, whereas mm-hmm. headquarters obviously is, there's just one. And so so Seattle's our biggest office, and then San Diego and San Francisco is next biggest in terms of the number of people, so we're about 25 people there. And then in San Diego, it's our next biggest space, which we're actively trying to fill. So we're really excited about hiring locally in San Diego. We're excited about working with local clients in San Diego. And then we also serve clients from around the country and the world from this office, from all offices. So while each office has people that live there and the teams that work there, we still have interdisciplinary teams across the company. And it kind of depends on, and there's a bunch of sort of if-ands of how we put teams together. And so we try to be as close to the client as possible, which is why we have multiple offices, to try to be closer to our clients. Mm. So our clients are spread all over the country. They always have been. And we used to just fly to them. And so we would fly for a kickoff meeting, do work back in Seattle, and then meet them however often we need to in person, which is generally probably 3 or 4 times in the course of a project. Mm-hmm. And that was fine. But now we have, you know, there's more volume, there's more people, and we're doing lots more work with specific clients. So like USAA, for example, it's better if we're there because there's more opportunity to start, you know, it's the,
right.
if I see you, I remember you kind of idea. And so the more we're there, the better opportunity we have to grow that account into something really big and interesting, which is part of our growth strategy, is to grow our big clients, to be able to help them and do more. And so in order to do that, it's better if we're closer to them, hence the Austin office. And then it's also, you know, part of the growth strategy as well is in order to serve these big clients, they want to have multiple projects and multiple teams going on at once, and we can't scale that quickly with our current staff, so we
right.
need more people. So that's why we need to hire. And so we've done some acquisitions in order to get a group of really smart people quickly. And they also come with revenue, so it's less, in terms of running the business, we don't want people sitting on the bench, we call it. So we're in a, you know, we're consultants, we get paid by the hour, so we really need all of our people billing to clients. That's how we stay in business. And so it's very straightforward on one hand, and the other hand, it's really complicated because it's hard to get all the pieces aligned so that people are on a project together, and then they come off that project, they go on to another one, and making sure there's no sort of downtime in between. Mm-hmm. And as we add more offices, it gives us more opportunity to have pull great teams together because we have talent from all over the place. And then we also have opportunities to not, if they're busy in San Francisco and, you know, we need someone, they need an extra body, and we have someone in San Diego, then that person will work on their team and they'll just work remotely. They'll go there a few times, but the same thing, they'll work remotely. So it really helps us keep the whole company utilized. We have more options.
Right.
And but at the same time, we have more options, so it's more complicated in terms of resourcing. So,
do you think that there's a fluidity between the culture in, let's say, Seattle and San Diego, where we are right now? Do you think it comes through? It sounds like, obviously, the caliber and the personality profile of the people that work with you, but also, is there architecture? Do you have, like, an ethos, you know, of the company that you kind of stand behind? Is there a monthly Zoom meetup where everyone's just hanging out?
Yeah,
how do you do
there
that?
There is, actually. In fact, it's a weekly staff meeting. So every Monday morning, the whole company dials in. And the staff meeting is currently hosted in Seattle. But then each office comes in and it's very choreographed. And it took us some time to get the kinks out of how do you make this a good experience for people in other offices so it doesn't look like the Seattle show.
Right.
And we're still working on that because, you know, certainly the other offices want to feel equally represented. So we're really working on that. And now we have, so excited, we just newly in this last month have general managers in three of our big offices. So Seattle, San Francisco, and San Diego all have general managers now. Mm-hmm. And they are responsible for representing their office, you know, at the highest levels of the company, but also, you know, in both directions. So making sure that there's a voice for that community, that office, mm-hmm. But also being part of the bigger company. And so, and soon we'll have that in Austin and Boston as well. We need a little more critical mass in those places.
Yeah.
But that's really helped, and it's helped with our, so we have that weekly stand-up, but then the GMs are also, you know, the hourly, the daily stand-ups to sort of make sure they are really making sure we're taking care of each office in a way that's part of the bigger company, but that's unique to them. Like, what do we need that's different in San Diego? It's Nikhil's job to know that and make sure it happens.
Yeah.
So that really helps. And then also, with your earlier question about the culture, so we have some basic foundations. We have a cultural framework that we developed a few years ago when we were growing really quickly all of a sudden. I wanted to make sure that we had a way to not only preserve our culture, which had a great feeling. You could come into the office when we were 20 or 30 people and you could feel the energy, but you couldn't really describe it. It's like, what is it about this place? I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. people like to work together and they're helping each other and they're supportive and they're happy.
Yes.
Like, what is that? And so I was really, and it was all true, and I was really interested in, okay, so how do we preserve that? In order to preserve it, we need to be able to talk about it. So in order to talk about it, we need to have a language around it. So I started working with an outside consultant who helped me understand from a cognitive psychology background what causes people to thrive and how do you cause people to feel happy at work. Like, what is it? Is it the beer in the fridge or is it the ping pong table? And it turns out, no, those are outcomes of a great culture, but they are not what create a great culture.
Right.
So things that create a great culture are, so we developed this framework around six pillars. One is clarity, so understanding what's expected of you. And these are things, when you hear them, you're just like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And so, because if people know what their job is, then they're more likely to be able to accomplish it. And if they accomplish what was expected of them, they're going to feel good. They're going to feel productive and valued. And so then if someone leaves at the end of the day feeling valued, they're going to be more happy. And mm-hmm. so, you know, in my altruistic vision is if they're more happy when they leave the, you know, walk out the doors, then they're going to go home and they're going to be better family members. They're going to be happier neighbors,
yes,
friends, and, you know, and hopefully they spread that goodwill around them in their neighborhoods. And I think of the 10-10 effect of, you know, so they, you know, the 10 times the volume, the impact of our company is having outside in the broader world. Mm-hmm. And so that's what gets me really excited about growing the company, really, because if we can, you know, stay true to this culture and provide this kind of environment for hundreds and hundreds of people instead of a few dozen, then we can have a really big impact just in being a great company. And this is totally aside from all the clients that we impact from being this way with them. They really love working with us. And they'll tell you over and over again, like that team, wow, they work together they worked with us, and they were so lovely, and they're so smart, and you know, they've changed our company. Mm-hmm. And so when I hear reports like that, I just think, oh, that's why we do this. It's really great.
Yeah, I mean, and you've talked about several times over discussing these issues, this kind of big picture mentality that mm-hmm. you're not just capable of maintaining, but you really thrive in. Yeah. You know, and it's your modus operandi, if you will. It's really where you go. And I'm wondering, did you have that from the beginning of launching with Carrie, the two of you? Did you have this big picture? And if so, if you had it then and you have it now, where are you headed next?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I think, you know, so now the goal is to be the world's leading UX firm. And I think, well, nobody else is awesome. Doing that, so why not us? Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah.
And we're perfectly positioned. We've been doing this for a long time, and we're really good at it. So that's where we're headed. And I didn't always feel that way, because honestly, when we first started, I was it's always been a big vision, but it's always just sort of been, you know, relative to what we're doing. So when we started, the big vision was like, oh my God, let's go do this on our own. And that was sort of a big deal at the time. So that was a giant leap. So I'm never afraid of taking a giant leap or having something, a big lofty thing in front of me. And right now, you know, it's the same relativity in that, you know, starting a company or, you know, just going out on our, it wasn't even starting a company. We weren't even doing that. We were just the two of us going to go and work together. It wasn't even as big as, you know, we had a name for it. So, I mean, we did start a company, but it wasn't like, let's start a company and what should it be? It was like, let's go do this job we love, get some clients, and I guess we need a company in order to do that. It was more like that. Mm-hmm. So everything was kind of one step at a time, but it was always, there were always big leaps. You know, even hiring our first person was kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And so now, being the world's leading UX firm, it's kind of like, well, yeah, of course, like, what else are we going to do? It sounds crazy, but it's really not that far away when you sort of look at the landscape. So I've always been like that, but the, you know, the goal, I didn't start out going, hey, let's be huge. Because at the time, we didn't think we would have more work than just the two of us could do. And we didn't need any more work. You know, we just needed one job to keep us both busy, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we got two jobs, and all of a sudden we were overwhelmed, like, we got to hire someone, we can't do it. Yeah. So we hired our first employee on contract. It was about 6 months after we started. And he's here in the office too. He still works here, John Dirks. He's our chief of research.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And then 8 months after that, we hired our second employee, Heidi Atkinson, who is also still here. She's one of our principal designers.
So that sock drawer question is really working for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They're
and we
still
have a
around.
Lot of long-term employees like that. Those two are definitely the first, and it's so exciting that they're still here. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big thinker for sure and visionary. I love coming up with, for me, the ideas just sort of come out of, you know, what more can we do? And then I don't let anything in the side that could possibly get in the way of that vision is a big part of it. So I have, you know, the focus helps. I have, mm-hmm. you know, these blinders on it's like the horse going down the street with the blinders on. I don't want to see the naysayers whizzing by because there's plenty of them.
Yeah.
And one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from a woman named Diane Tice. She's wonderful woman. She said to me, be careful who you tell your dreams to. And and I looked at her, I'm like, you know, what do you mean? And she's like, most people will want to tell you it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, be very careful when you have big ideas who you share them with. Only ever share them with people who you know will support you. Because otherwise, you don't need to hear from anybody that something's not possible. Particularly if you have a very big idea, most people can't get their head around it. There aren't too many people who are probably going there with you. They're not thinking about this thing that you're thinking about day and night, and you haven't mm-hmm. thought through the whole thing, and they don't maybe not have the courage or the vision or whatever it is. And so you have to expect when you have big ideas, you're going to be kind of out there on your own. But then you pull in people who will support you for various aspects of it.
Right.
You know, like, oh, you're strong, you'll definitely be able to do it. Or how about this part of your idea and let me help you develop that? Or, you know, you want to just surround yourself by those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
And including, she even said, you know, like I tell young girls, like, don't tell your brother if you have a great idea, because he's probably going to tell you that you're stupid. And so, you know, it's like, so what's the best way to not get that feedback? Don't tell them. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that's really interesting, because you kind of want to go tell the world all your great ideas, and you should be very careful.
Yeah, people. I think that we acquire other people's baggage.
Absolutely.
More often than not, you know, and especially with the entrepreneurial spirit, across all genders. I think there's something about, I've just seen this social, you know, custom, if you will, of people almost more tempted not to than say, that's not going to happen for you. You know, it's that gusto that we kind of want to quiet. And I think it comes from a place of individual baggage. It actually doesn't come from assessing them appropriately and describing the probability of whether or not successful outcome is going to happen. You know, I think that it's just this baggage that we associate, and then, you know, we can take on with us and, like you're saying, kind of kill that idea.
Well, and a lot of people are afraid of failure, and they're just fearful, and low risk takers, for example. And that's another thing that helps me, is that I love risk. I'm not a I'm a high risk taker, so that helps. Mm-hmm. But you know, people might take, you know, this big vision and imagine themselves doing it, and it's terrifying for them, and so then they'll sort of put that back on you, when really it's their baggage. So I think I just think it's important to
Well, and as a female, let's get into, I mean, you are a pillar as a female co-founder in the design community, but the larger tech, you know, world at large, you know, there's the female founders and co-founders are kind of what spawned this podcast series. But getting into your personal history with that, you know, you have a little bit of dialogue about how that's changed over the past 20 plus years or whatever. Can you speak to some of, as a female co-founder starting off in the beginning of maybe five, you know, and now having joined a larger community and the dialogue in that, do you have a personal narrative in there?
Yeah. I would often, it sort of 10 years ago or so, I would, when we were starting to become more well known, I would have people calling me, and reporters or different people trying to write about us or talk about us. And they would ask me, you know, what's it like being a woman CEO in a high tech world? And in Seattle at the time, you know, it was pretty booming, and still is. Mm-hmm. And I would always answer, oh, it's great. Why are you asking?
Right.
And I was very naive, and I was living in this real bubble. And so, you know, with enough of those kind of questions, I would say, you know, oh, it's great. And, well, you're the only one. Isn't it sort of lonely? And I'm like, I'm not the only one. I mean, I just had lunch with 10 other women, you know, leaders. And so I'm not, like, you're crazy. I'm not the only one. And I really believe at the time, and still now, and it's all over the place, people look for evidence to support their beliefs. And so if the media is telling them, which it does constantly, that women aren't running companies, women aren't doing this, they're not doing that, you know, we have so far to go in the wage gap, which we do, but we're making progress. And in leadership, certain companies, all these things, we still have a long ways to go, but we are making great progress. And there are many, many, many examples of companies and women who are doing great things. Mm-hmm. And so I really believe that we should be focused on, let's look for evidence to support the belief that women are doing great things, period. And if we start showcasing these examples, which your podcast does, which is so beautiful, that, hey, it's out there. Let's talk to them.
Right.
And you don't have to be the first one. Yeah, we need more, so come on, let's go.
Mm-hmm.
So I would always point these people to examples of other women doing great things. And this is sort of the genesis of my nonprofit was, Hey, girls, there are lots of women doing cool things, and let's talk about them. Let me show you what they look like.
Yes.
And it may not be a perfect mapping to them, because I know it is important for a lot of girls to see themselves. And I'd also always encourage girls to say, and women, okay, so if you can't find the role model that looks just like you, then make sure that you're the one that looks just like you, because it's you. And so if you can't see the role model, then it's your job to be that role model.
Nice.
And so use whatever you need to, you like scrap your way to get there. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of amazing people out there who can be role models. You know, like for me, you know, it's, you know, like Bill Gates, like he's done some amazing things. And, you know, there's some sordid past as well, but, you know, he doesn't look anything like me. It's okay.
Right.
I'm like, wow, he had courage. He had, you know, drive. He had a big idea. And so I'm looking for people like that, like who had big ideas and who made them happen. Those are my mentors, and I don't care what they look like.
Right.
And so I'm looking at like, what does courage look like? And what is perseverance look like, and what is, you know, what does failure look like? Because in most all of the cases, any single person who has been successful has more failures than they do successes.
Yes.
To their record. And yet we tend to just look at the big bright shiny objects and forget all of the things that went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if we if we realize that we're all human, and as long as you get back up, then you're going to be a whole lot stronger from that giant failure than you were before then. And so the important thing is, while you're down there in the darkest trenches, to keep going and hang in there and know that it won't last forever. Mm-hmm. And then when you get back up, make sure you're learning from it. And that's resilience. And they've, you know, there's study after study that shows resiliency is what helps people come out of hard places. It's what gets people out of poverty. It's what has people change their lives. It's what causes great companies. Mm-hmm. You know, and even for Blink, we had plenty of tough times along the way, but if you just give up, then you're not, then there's no chance, you know, because right. nothing is ever handed on a silver platter.
No, and I feel like resiliency is a road to self-awareness, which mm-hmm. furthers one's path.
Absolutely.
You know, this idea that, you know, resiliency allows you to continue on, and throughout a theme throughout the series over the past year and a half has been not the billionaires club, you know, and I've interviewed some billionaires, yeah. but it's really about how we rise from the fall. And I believe it's about that self-discovery that you're saying, you know, comes, I believe, through what you're saying, this resilience mm-hmm. is that self-discovery, and then skyrockets you, or has the potential to skyrocket you from that, you right. know. But it's those failures, I think, that we have the opportunity, as painful as it is, to get to know oneself.
Absolutely.
And really hang out, and then come back up from it stronger than we were before. We kind of got into the Girls Can Do. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell the story of that. I think that the way that it started is just such a fantastically auspicious, I don't know, okay, moment. So can you give us a little background on your nonprofit Girls Can Do?
Sure. So it sort of spun out of many of these phone calls of, you know, me saying, okay, let me give you 10 names. I want you to call them. These are great women that are out there. And, you know, at the same time, getting more and more frustrated with the news and the reporting on what women aren't doing. And it makes me so mad. In fact, it made me so mad that I literally stopped reading the news. I don't watch the news. I don't listen to the radio. I drive in silence. And sometimes I have loud music or else nothing. Uh-huh. And because I got so tired of hearing other people's view of the world and treating it like the truth. And so the problem is, you watch all these cars driving beside me, listen to the radio, and whatever's being said on the radio, in particular NPR, let's say in the morning, whatever they're saying becomes that person's truth for the day. And if they happen to say on that radio, let's say they're talking about the US soccer team mm-hmm. and their recent court case, which I think is amazing. What if they said, they did a whole dialogue on the stats of where women are not being paid equally and how they're not being treated equally and on and on and on.
Right.
They could talk about the stats in the negative, or they could talk about them in the positive. They could say, these are the progress we've made. These are the differences that have happened. This is where we're making progress. This is where we're going. Isn't it great? We're moving. Instead, they talk about, it's still so bad. It's still this, it's still that. And it just started making me so mad, because then everyone's walking around, particularly, you know, younger people, and they're hearing this, and it becomes their truth, and they're not listening to it with a critical mind, mm-hmm. and they're not saying, are they thinking outside of the box here, or should I look around for my own eyes? Like, I really say to people, like, make sure you're seeing with your own eyes and you're feeling with your own heart. I read that somewhere, and I'm just like, oh my God, that's it, because mm-hmm. don't let someone else tell you what's true. Make sure you believe it, you know it for yourself. And this is kind of the basis of the work we do at Blink too with our research, is that we're not designing software based on what we think our users want. It's based on what we know they want, because we interview them. It's all based on research.
Yeah.
And so I encourage everyone, make sure you have your own research for how you think about the world. And so so for Girls Can Do, I had read this one article, and oh my God, it made me so mad. It was, I'm a big skier, so it was in a big skiing magazine, and a good friend of mine who, she's a professional skier, or she's a good friend of mine now. At the time, she was an acquaintance. She skis at our local hill in Seattle, Crystal Mountain. And they had written this article, but she's in all the ski movies. She's great. Mm. They had written this beautiful article about her in Powder Magazine, the big magazine, a beautiful 5-page spread. She's so great.
Nice.
And they had this one paragraph in the middle that said, you know, and, you know, this is a tough act, and she's super unusual, because for women to be in the film business, let alone the sports, you know, ski film business, it's nearly impossible. The men have the racket, they get all the money, they don't support women, and it just went on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And then they said, this is what was the kicker for me, and it mirrors corporate life. And I just thought, why do you have to say it? Now, all girls,
corporate life, that's
yeah,
like just,
yeah, this is the corporate world, gone. Exactly. Sports business, just like corporate business. And I thought, any young girl that's reading that, depressing. You just wrecked it. You just totally, like, why would I ever want to do that after reading that?
Yeah.
And it made me so mad that I saw her not long after, and I said, you know, hey, Ingrid, what was with that? And she said, I don't know. I didn't say a word about it. And she said, I don't know where they got that. I don't know why they said it. And I said, well, you know, I'm really bummed out. I want all the girls to know that it really is a cool job that you're doing, and they could totally do that for a job if they wanted to. And it's great. It's supportive. Her husband's in the business. They all love each other. The women are all colleagues, right. And, you know, some of the women are producing movies as well. Mm-hmm. And so I said, and at the time in my office in Seattle, we have an art gallery as part of the office just for fun, because I always wanted to have an art gallery. Mm-hmm. And so being an art major, I thought, oh my God, we're going to have one in my office, and then we can have an event a couple times a year.
Yes.
And we bring in artists and speakers, and it's super fun. So I thought, well, maybe for one of those events, I would have Ingrid come and talk, and we would fill the house with girls. Wouldn't that be fun? And so I had this crazy idea, and I said to her, I'm like, what if we did this? Like, would you be willing to come to my office and give a talk to girls and tell them how great it is? And she said, and I totally expected her to say, you know, I'm very busy, I fly around the world, I don't really have time, maybe next year. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, that sounds great, I'd love to. And I was waiting for the but, and there was no but. And uh-huh. She said, how about May when I'm back from tour? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, okay, this was in late January, so I had a few months.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, okay, okay, great. And so I went off, and then I started thinking, well, she's quite famous. Like, I bet you we could hold about 200 people in our office at the time, max. And I thought, oh, God, what if we get, you know, we're going to fill the house. Maybe I'll rent a little place, you know, one time just for fun. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I'm going to rent a place, then maybe I should get someone else, and we'll have two women speakers. And I'll get someone that's totally different, and they can see the contrast. And we'll invite lots of girls. And so, God, before you know it, I had, within 4 months, I had rented the Seattle Symphony Hall, the Benaroya Hall, which holds 2,000 people. And I had invited 10 speakers who I had just called up. And this is a perfect example, and you should always ask, because mm-hmm. you'll be shocked at how often people say yes. And so I would call these random people right. who I liked, who I thought had great stories, and had. I really wanted them to talk about failure. At this point, it had become obvious to me that that was an important discussion point,
yeah.
that people understood success is never handed on a silver platter, and we should be talking about failure and how do you get through that? Who helped you? What were your strategies, your coping mechanisms, and how did you get yourself back on your feet? I think that's really important, particularly if you look at girls who are, you know, underserved in any kind of way. You know, they don't have parents who are supporting them, they don't have enough money, they don't have enough education. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we help them think differently about their lives? And not, I never wanted to take lightly their circumstances and assume that, oh yeah, if you have a mentor, you can do anything. Because there are some real hard times that people live in. And so still the research has proven that resiliency is what gets people in a new situation.
Right.
And so right away I became, because when I started going down this path, I did a lot of research, and I talked to a lot of people on how can I have an event that's not lip service, and that's really helping girls. And so this was what came out of that. So anyway, I called up all these random people, including Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time, and I thought, oh, maybe she'll keynote.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
This is after I had been in it for a couple of months, and I had gotten all these yeses, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And so they did not say no. And in the end, she couldn't do it, but I talked to one of her senior advisors 3 times, and they were very, very interested, and there was a slight chance she was going to come. In the end, she couldn't, but I just thought, oh, well, who cares? I got all I needed from that. Like,
yes.
Like the confidence that this is important. And what came out of all that was, for me, it was just an event, and I had no idea the impact that it would have. I was absolutely astounded by the number of girls who came who said, that was the best day of my life. Hmm. And it was a 4-hour event. And I just thought, oh my God, like, there's work to be done here.
Right.
And then the speakers said the same thing. They said, you know, we talk, these were high profile women, we talk, you know, to the corporate law association, you know, I talk to all these young lawyers all the time. This was Sabrina Jenkins, the head of corporate counsel for Starbucks, who I called, and I'm like, hey, would you do this? And mm-hmm. yet she'd never had the opportunity to share her story with girls. And she got kicked out of law school, right? And now look at her now. And so she wanted to, you know, really connect with them. And they all hung around. They stayed for the whole day. They chatted with girls afterwards. They were so happy that this was a one and done event for me. And then I was going to get some sleep because I was doing this in the evenings and the weekends.
Right.
And they sort of ganged up on me and they said, "Right, where are we going now? You know, this is too important. We can't stop."
Yeah.
And so, you know, long story short, it's still pretty early in its stages. We've done 3 events now and with thousands and thousands of girls. And, you know, again, the impact of like one day is just phenomenal to me.
Yeah.
How it's not that hard to make a difference, honestly.
No, it's huge. Did you do all 3 events in Seattle?
2 in Seattle and 1 in D.C.
Okay.
And so then the idea now, the plan is to go across the whole country and have events in every major city.
It needs it, yes.
And then continue to repeat them so that, you know, depending on our bandwidth, it'll be, you know, maybe Seattle once every 3 years or whatever, but we'll continue to go back to the same cities.
So. Yeah, and I think partnering and liaisons, and I agree. I think these, you know, people think one day, and I think the impact that it can have on a young life and old life is surmountable. You know, we don't string together millions of different memories when we think, why did we choose to do something major? It's usually one moment.
Sure.
It's one day. Movement. So I think it's an incredible platform.
Yeah.
And I want it to continue forward.
We partner with so that the girls have something each day to carry them forward. Mm-hmm. We partner with local organizations in that city, so in DC or Seattle at the time, who have year-over-year after-school programming for girls, and in all kinds of ways. So we had in DC, we had 20 organizations that came, and they get to have like a little expo in the lobby, so they have a booth and the girls can go learn about them. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, coding, there was welding, there was running, writing, you name it, the whole thing. And so the idea is that a girl gets inspired by at least one of the speakers, and then she gets excited about at least one of the organizations that she can sign up for. And they all had to be willing to take signups that day, and then the girls can really get involved in a community. So we're
that's awesome.
To hook them up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that young networking, right? It's that community based. I like that. Well, kind of moving on with that that zeitgeist of, you know, girls can do. You personally are a wealth of knowledge, and I could spend about 5 hours just asking you questions because I love your response. You have a very tenacious attitude and career that reflects that attitude. And so I wanted to ask you, what if you were advising a young entrepreneur who had just come down in a pickup truck from her father's house into the States, and she was like, "Yeah, I'm going to get involved into some design. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. World's my oyster." What would be like the top 3 pieces of advice you would offer her right now?
Top 3. Well, I think the one thing is, you know, I suggest to people, make sure you're walking with your head up. And what I mean by that is be open to what's coming. And you don't even have to, I'm not talking about looking for opportunities or knocking on doors necessarily. I'm just saying, you know, in every moment of every day, be open to what's presented to you. And I think if you continue to do things that you love, which is really important, you know, so I you know, in all my studies, I loved every class I ever took, period, every class. And I think that's really important. If you just focus on doing what you love, walking around with your head up and being open to what's presented to you, and really evaluating everything with a why not attitude, then that is absolutely how my entire life has gone. I could never have predicted anything, nothing, not even, you know, I never had any plans to move to the States. You know, and even the job I got when I lived in Spain, I mean, I worked at the World's Fair at the EC Pavilion. It was the coolest job you could ever get. And that was like from a guy that I met in the bar. You know, it's just like being open and saying, why not? And I think, you know, and having courage, but the courage is something that you can actually, you can develop it in yourself. So you're not born with courage. Courage is something that you can develop. And so I think, and it really comes from self-talk. So it's what you say to yourself. Mm-hmm. You can convince yourself that anything is possible. And you have to be very careful about, this is when, be careful who you tell your dreams to. Be careful who you hang around with. Don't hang around with people who are negative. Just stop. Including family members. So there are family members who are negative. Spend less time with them. Be careful what you talk to them about. You know, don't open yourself up to negative feedback or negative criticism, and you can absolutely be in control of that. So it's being in control of who you hang around with, and you know, listening for opportunities from the lady at the checkout of the grocery store. Like, they're everywhere. There are people all around you at every moment who can just sort of give you a new idea, and if you take that idea and just entertain it, then great things will happen. I mean, I absolutely guarantee it. It like every little thing, even just, you know, having a chat with your Lyft driver or the waitress, you know, they've always got something interesting about life that is just worth hearing, I think.
Yeah.
And so, and I think inspiration comes from all kinds of strange little places, and you have to really be open to engaging in ways that you might, that you couldn't plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you never know what's going to happen today. It's sort of how I wake up every day. I'm like, I don't know what's going to happen today. I mean, I've got some meetings I got to go to, but you know, what right. we talk about is in between the meetings are really, that's the magic.
Yeah. 1,000%. So staying open.
Staying open, and then, you know, developing your own courage to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that comes from telling yourself, I can do this. Why not? Somebody's got to do it. Why not me? If you just say that to yourself all day long, you're going to get all this power to go do something that you didn't think you were going to do. And all of a sudden you'll find yourself doing it. You'll be like, well, it's not so bad after all. Mm-hmm. And then once you start doing it, then you get the momentum and the flywheel starts going of being courageous, and then you'll do more and more things.
Yeah.
And I think you can also practice in little ways. So I practice being courageous and pushing myself out of my comfort zone, which is largely how I operate. So basically my job is to be out of my comfort zone, because everything I'm doing is something new. And so I'm always, no matter what I'm doing, my job is to push us forward into areas we've never been in before. Mm-hmm. And so that can feel very uneasy at times. You know, is this the right thing to do? Is this the right thing to do? I'm always asking that. And so what I have to learn how to decipher in my own mind and body is the feeling of, this is just out of my comfort zone because I've never done it before, versus this is a bad feeling. Mm-hmm. And knowing the difference between the two is really important. And so what I try to do is nurture this feeling of out of my comfort zone in sports. And so like for skiing, I like to backcountry ski. So I'll like go off, you know, a steep cliff that scares the hell out of me, because it's good practice, because I know that feeling. This is a feeling because I've never done it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I kite surf, and every time I do that, I'm scared. And so I have the, because there's a lot going on. And so it's really high focus, high energy, high risk in a lot of ways. And so that helps me know, I get really comfortable with that feeling of I'm doing something new,
mm-hmm.
and it's okay. It's just doing something new versus something that's really not good, and you have to trust your instincts.
Yeah, and I think what you said is right. You alluded to courage, and I think bravery as well. There's a small distinction within that, but I think they both have their own momentum that they gain, and people who haven't started off on that journey, you know, maybe can't see that. Being brave after one has been brave or courageous is much easier, you know,
right.
The millionth time it starts to, and you develop, as you're talking about, these very finely tuned, you know, relationships between what it is to be a little uneasy because you're new at something or in a new circumstances versus a bad situation.
Right.
And I like that. I like that conversation, that as it, you know, as it matriculates, it becomes more mature within itself as well.
There's a great song that I love. And even if you have a little song for yourself, right, to get, you know, get your guts up.
What song?
It's from The Sound of Music. So when Maria comes out of the convent, she's going to the home for the first time. She's, you know, scared. She's terrified of what's in front of her. And then she starts, you know, singing a song that she has confidence in her, and that everyone will believe it because they'll see that she's confident, and all of a sudden it's that you get the momentum there. So I think you can absolutely convince yourself of anything.
Yeah, I think the final line of that song is, I have confidence in me, or something.
Exactly.
Me is the last note. I like that. That's cool. So I always end the conversation with a bird's eye view into, you know, where Karen Clark Cole is at. What is your, what are you most looking forward to doing? Let's see, today's a Wednesday. So anytime from beginning last Monday through next Wednesday, what are you most looking forward to doing? And what have you done so far in the past week that you're most proud of?
Well, I can tell you, having these kind of conversations is something that I really look forward to. You know, I think I get really excited when I see, you know, young people, you know, not just women, but just young people on the verge of something big and exciting. And so I think, you know, for me, it's really fun to be back in that space in the event that we had last night, the Startup Grind here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fun for me to go back there, because it's easy to forget where we've come from and where I've come from, because I'm so busy working on the next thing. And
right.
So I really try to, you know, find ways to sort of go back in time to say, you know, to sit and be proud for a minute. Because I don't get a lot of time for that, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really very focused on making sure, you know, the company is, it's a big company now, and I have a lot of responsibility to a lot of individuals to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's a serious pressure, and so it's nice for me to sort of take a break from that occasionally. And just sort of reflect in a bigger way. So I really look for opportunities to do that. Oddly enough, flying allows me to do that. I really, I love getting on planes. It's nice. Time alone and just being up in the air with the big picture view of the earth.
I was just going to say, it's your big picture physical moment.
It really is important to me. And then there's some various other elements, but it really allows me time to sort of sit and reflect, which I don't do enough of truthfully. And so I look for ways to do that. I have a 10.5-year-old daughter, and I look forward to being with her whenever I'm not working. And that really gives me a break from it all. And it reminds me of, you know, what's important in life, beyond running a company and making sure that every little bit and piece is going well. I guess what I'm saying is any opportunity I get in the next week or I look at my calendar, I'm like, oh, there's an hour, I'm going to block it before somebody else does, so I can just sort of take a break. And just sort of live life, you know, and I love vacations and going on trips, and I have a running ritual that I run, and that's really sort of my meditation time, where I don't listen to music and I really just try to listen to my breathing, and that always helps me reset. So I kind of look forward to, truthfully, what I'm looking forward to is I don't have any meetings tomorrow morning, and I'm going to block it off, and I'm going to go to the pool at the hotel, and I'm going to go for a run, and I might get a massage.
Lovely.
That's what I'm truthfully looking for.
Yes. Why wouldn't you? That's perfect. I love that you love vacations. This is the second or third time I've heard you say that. I don't think that we have a proper work-life balance model in front of us. Sometimes as Americans, we've got this I work 80, I work 90, I work, how many hours would we be working? And you unabashedly said, I love vacations. Yeah. 2, 3, 4 days, it's great if I can truly vacation. I thought, it's true, it's sleep. It's, and your marriage with sleep. You have another kind of...
It's really important. Yeah, the 8 hours sleep is what makes you smart. Your brain can't function without it. And so, my job is largely to make decisions and preferably good ones. Mm-hmm. So I take it as my job responsibility to take care of myself so that I can, operate the company in a way that's smart.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your morning.
Thank you. Block
tomorrow.
I hope you get it.
You, me, and all the listeners. Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for sitting down with me today. I don't believe I've met with a woman that I don't consider to be vibrant and amazing in her own right. But today was special, and I want to thank you so much. You're so busy. All are, but I think you just a touch more. So thank you for sitting down with me.
Thank you. That was
I really
super fun.
Appreciate it. To everyone listening, until I chat with you again next time, thank you so much for spending the hour with me, and remember to always bet on yourself. Sunshine.